8. That's Sunday, April 27th, the Social Justice Center of Marin celebrates free speech.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Up next, Terra Verde.
Hello, Bay Area and beyond. You're tuned to Terra Verde on KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. I'm your host, Laura Garzon Chica. If you're interested in reimagining and remaking the economy so that people and the planet can truly prosper, then keep the dial locked to 94.1 FM. Earth Day is around the corner and May Day is coming up too. So what better time to discuss the interesting ways that the labor and environmental movements intersect? Here at KPFA, we're not far from Silicon Valley, where you hear many acclaim about how innovative companies make the world a better place. But I'm not talking about tech workers today, at least not the kind you generally think of. In fact, I've reached out to three prominent organizers who work with many kinds of workers around the Bay Area towards a new economy with environmental aims. I'd like to warmly welcome to the studio Brooke Anderson of Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project, Stephanie Hervey of the Sunflower Alliance, the Action Hub in Richmond, and other organizations, as well as Elliot Hughes of the Industrial Workers of the World's Environmental Unionism Caucus. Thank you for joining us on Terra Verde.
No, thanks.
So, Elliot, let's start with you. You've been spotted around the Bay a lot lately carrying these flyers that say Earth Day to May Day. It's a direct action assembly. So tell us, what's in the works with this?
So, yeah, basically in the past couple of weeks, we've been meeting a whole lot to build on the intersections of environmental justice and labor and kind of take a radical step to start taking direct action. So we've been doing assemblies and meetings on every Sunday to kind of plan these direct actions, and we actually came up with a big direct action and events calendar that you can actually find at earthdaytomaydayassembly.noblogs.org. And so there's a really big calendar. There's an Earth Day March in Berkeley on the 22nd. There's going to be guerrilla gardening in West Oakland on the 23rd. On the 24th, we're going to be doing a really big direct action training day with film screenings. And Burkett's going to be helping me with that as well. And we're going to be having a full day of direct action trainings, workshops, and workshops on how to use a diversity of nonviolent direct action tactics, such as pickets, strikes, lockdowns, banner drops, blockades, security culture, and the list goes on, like legal observations, stuff like that. But there's going to be some really great films as well. Rocking the Foundations is a really good film about the Builders Laborers Federation, who in 1971 and 1974 called a bunch of green bands, and basically they're a union going against their economic interests in striking and calling bans on development projects because they were either destroying the earth, destroying indigenous communities, or gentrifying neighborhoods. So they would basically, you know, they're the people that were supposed to construct these, like, new buildings and skyscrapers and things, but they refused to work in solidarity with the community and the planet. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really powerful moment in history.
And that was in New South Wales, correct?
Yeah, that was in New South Wales. They actually halted $18 billion worth of development and called 42 green bands.
Wow.
And eventually, the larger union and the bureaucrats disbanded them from the union to try to stop it from happening. And so basically what I would like to see is a revival of that tactic to reunite the workers and environmentalists to start challenging these industries, whether it's the oil industry, whether it's the logging industry, or any, you know, anywhere in any of our workplaces where there's environmental destruction. I believe that the workers have the right to not only stand for our own rights, but for the rights of the environment, because it's our health and safety.
That makes sense. And there has been actions here. I mean, we have a lot of historical precedents, of course, like you mentioned, and I'll put up the website later on our archive, so people can go find out the specifics of how to get to that viewing. But, Brooke, let's talk to you, because there was an action that happened last year that's sort of in this spirit called Summer Heat, and it was huge. So tell us about what your role was and what went down that day.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for convening us to talk about this topic. So, you know, I've been in the labor movement as both a union organizer and elected official of a union over the course of the last 14 or 15 years. And one of the things that I've seen in the labor movement is that, you know, if we look at the if we look at climate disruption and we look at the attacks on workers, we see the same root of that, right? We have an economy that is really structured in a way to generate profit for the few at the expense of the many. And it does that by doing two different things. One is exploiting workers and human labor, and the other is taking our natural resources, right? And so one of the things that we understand is if economic exploitation, the exploitation of human labor, is being used to destroy our planet and destroy our home, that it's necessary to reclaim our labor and democratize our labor as one of the first things we need to do to restore our relationship to place and to planet. And so last year we formed a labor contingent for climate justice, as you were mentioning, where we had 30 different labor unions, worker centers, worker cooperatives, and worker justice organizations that pulled together this contingent and marched with a larger Summer Heat action against the Keystone XL pipeline and against the Chevron refinery on the one-year anniversary of the Chevron refinery fire that sent 15,000 people to local hospitals in Richmond. And this is part of an effort to build a broader grassroots labor movement for climate justice. And what we know we really need to do is to transition out of the dirty and deadly extreme energy economy and into industries that are into a really a new economy that is based on social justice, that's based on economic democratization, that's based on ecological restoration, and to fight for new jobs in that economy that are, you know, moving from industrial scale agriculture to small scale urban farming, that are moving from highways to dignified, accessible, and affordable public transportation, that are helping to remake our waterways and our watersheds with new jobs. And so it's part of this broader grassroots labor movement for climate justice.
It sure is. And it was a powerful sight. There were a lot of sunflowers at the event, from what I understand. And I also understand that you, Stephanie, took the lead there, or one of many leaders there who made that happen. Why sunflowers? And what are you doing now carrying on that message?
Well, sunflowers, again, thank you for having us here to speak about this subject that is really passionate to all three of us who come from, you know, different backgrounds. We all have the same vision. The Summer Heat action was dealing with destruction, and so the sunflowers were a symbol of regeneration and transformation of nature, and we wanted the action to be very colorful with all of the different aspects. So we had the labor as an intersection, the economic issue with the economic group, alternative economic groups were there, and my purpose was to bring the farm, the urban farmers and the farmers there to the table. And so one of the ideas was to plant sunflowers, but we were thinking, well, maybe they'll just root them all up. So we wanted something that had a standing symbol and a standing vision. And so we ordered over 1,500 sunflowers, and there were about one sunflower per every three or four people. So we estimated there's about 3,000 people at the event that day.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And a coalition came out of that, right? The Sunflower Alliance.
Yeah, the Sunflower Alliance coalition. Actually, it was interesting because I was not there the day that they decided to call it the Sunflower Alliance. But somebody called me and said, hey, we decided that we like this intersection of labor, farming, ecology, and environmental social justice, and we want to continue to move down that direction. A lot of times we realize that the means to get somewhere, we don't all agree on how we're going to get to our vision, but we do agree on the vision. And so the Sunflower Alliance is a very diverse group of folks. I know Elia gets involved in a lot of direct action, you know, in there with the workers from the day-to-day, and you know, Brooke is working a lot with the building up the cooperative movement and that sort of thing. I am working a lot with the social justice movement within vulnerable communities that include seniors, communities of color, economically disadvantaged communities where these toxic hotspots just they sit in these communities. And when we liberate ourselves and we say, okay, we're done with this, they can no longer operate at the level that they are.
Right. Yeah, the strategy of just bringing so many people together from so many different walks of life seems like the way to go these days. I want to hear more actually from you, Brooke, just about that process of reaching out to the unions when you organized for this event. And we don't have to just focus on this one event. I mean, this is an ongoing thing. We have the May Day to Earth Day events as well coming up. But is it more about health and safety when you approach these people? Those are the terms that you want to focus on? Can we talk about climate change as well? Mm-hmm. Is it a combination? What do you find?
Good question. So one of the things that I think is important to building a grassroots labor movement for climate justice is really building up the base of rank and file workers who understand their lived experience of climate change as connected to the current economy that we're in. And so part of what we've been doing are dozens of trainings for rank and file workers, for staff organizers, for elected leadership of unions, and also for worker cooperatives about the connection between our current economy, between capitalism, and how that creates ecological disruption, or what including but not limited to climate change, and how that then also creates forced displacement, right? So we end up seeing a huge forced migration around the world of workers who've been pushed out of their home countries, who've had their relationship to place and to land that has existed in their family for many, many generations disrupted, who've ended up in the United States working in industries that not only break their bodies, if we're talking about, we're talking about loggers, we're talking about miners, we're talking about farm workers, we're talking about recycling workers, and are also destroying the earth, right? And so part of what we do is do these bilingual workshops that connect up capitalism, ecological destruction, forced migration, and worker rights here, but then also bring in this piece around just transition and how do we fight for a new economy. And I think that is, that type of popular education is really important. We, in fact, just did training for recycling workers here in Alameda County who, despite the fact that they are really frontline climate workers, if we think about what it's going to take to restore our relationship and to place and to ecosystems, recycling workers are part of what are bringing down our carbon dioxide levels, and they are making some of the worst wages of recycling workers across the entire Northern California, and they're sifting through every day through dead rats and asbestos and condoms and needles and exploding paint containers, and they're making $10, $11 an hour. And so we know that it's not enough just to transition into jobs that are good for the climate, but those jobs actually have to be living wage jobs. They have to be union or worker cooperative jobs. They have to be dignified jobs with respect. Many of those same recycling workers were actually, when they stood up for their rights, were fired and the company cited their immigration status. So these also have to be jobs where we really respect the plurality of folks who live in the Bay Area, wherever they wherever folks have come through from, wherever languages folks speak, and really bring forth a grassroots movement that says we need these types of jobs, but they have to be good jobs. We also know that many workers live next to extreme energy and face those consequences. So a lot of union workers live in Richmond and say, my child has asthma, or my aunt went to the hospital during the refinery fire and are ready to fight. There are other union workers, for instance, the nurses, who the California Nurses Association have just been an incredible example of leading the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. And they've sort of found what we would call their front line or their self-interest in this fight, which is that they are the first folks who treat victims and survivors of climate catastrophe and the consequences of extreme energy, whether that is the Richmond Chevron refinery explosion or whether that's Typhoon Haiyan or Yolanda survivors. And so they've taken on a really strong role. And in fact, last night we're out there supporting the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, Communities for a Better Environment, and other organizations in Richmond fighting the expansion of the Chevron refinery. So I think there's a lot of different ways to talk about the way that workers are impacted by the climate crisis, and to then plug those workers and their broader unions and worker cooperatives and organizations into the fight. And that's not labor supporting an issue like climate. It's us understanding that both the attack on workers and the destruction of our planet is coming from a shared economy that prioritizes pollution and profit over people and planet, and that we need to flip that equation.
Right. What are your thoughts, Elliot?
Oh, yeah. No,
I see you nodding your head.
No, I completely agree. I think that's a really solid point. I think that there's no separation of the destruction of the environment and the health and safety of workers. I think, if you look at the way that the world and ecology works, it's every single action that is taken on this planet in some way has an effect on all of us, you know? And that's like a really interesting thing, is in what ways does climate change and global warming intersect with all social justice issues, whether it's immigration issues because of climate change, there's mass migration, but the state and the capitalist response to that is tightening the borders and militarizing the police. And because of that, then that also causes more police brutality. The list goes on and on and on. Like, you could, just about any social justice issue has an intersection with climate change, because mm-hmm. climate change, How do I say this?
Why don't you pause for a moment?
Yeah.
Because I know we probably have some people that have just tuned in, and I should tell them that they're listening to Terra Verde, which is the weekly environmental talk show here on KPFA, 94.1 FM, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno. And we are talking about the ways that the environmental and labor movements are merging, have merged, and should merge. So if you have any follow-up thoughts, Elliot, go ahead.
So, yeah. To me, like, capitalism is inherently unsustainable. Yeah, like what Brooke said, you know, they view everything as a resource. They view human labor as a resource. They view the earth as a commodity, you know. They view our food as a commodity, and they don't care about, like, poisoning it. They don't care about exploiting the workers. They don't care about anything, really. The corporations and I would say even the state don't really care about anything. They just care about keeping their system going and making a profit and holding on to their power. And I think if we're going to make a just transition, we're going to have to demand that and take direct action to do that, whether it's with the Keystone XL pipeline or whether it's challenging any unsustainable industry. I think it's really up to the workers and the environmentalists to come together to challenge these industries together, to strike, to occupy and take over these industries, and collectivize them. And whatever cannot be transitioned, I think we just need to dismantle. You know, I don't think fracking could ever be sustainable, but, you know, the only way that we can really challenge that is if we can get those workers to refuse to do that work. And at once we can awaken them to the fact that, you know, fracking is destroying their tap water and poisoning millions of working class people around the world, you know, maybe they will call a green ban. Maybe we could get them to stop doing that work and realize that our long-term health is more worth it than, you know, having a little extra money in the pocket.
The ka-ching, ka-ching. That's right. I want to do one more dive into the dark side of what we're dealing with here, because Stephanie is fresh off of an event that happened last night, so I want to get the update on that, because if we are talking about shutting down these industries, or at least slowing them down, and then we'll leave a few minutes at the end to talk about what we're building up in its place. So tell us quickly, if you could, Stephanie, what happened last night in Richmond.
Well, yesterday it was a very interesting meeting with the Planning Commission. There were many, many labor workers there. I would estimate over 50 or 60 labor workers there, competing for 29 jobs. And I was discussing at this meeting with someone who was supporting one of the labor workers, who's saying, look, we got to get these guys jobs. We got to get these guys jobs. And I said, yeah, but how long are they going to work? Are they going to work 2 or 3 months? He said, they're going to be there for 2 years. I said, well, we need to find something that's a little bit more sustainable than that. And so we agreed to disagree. But after that conversation, there was someone from the labor, the movement, who he said that he was there to support, who wanted to talk to me, who said, you know what, you said something really you said something really good here. We have an issue with maintaining jobs. We're here every time there's an issue with a turnaround. We never have consistent jobs. We're always looking for the next number to be called. If we don't make it, you may not make the number to get on the job. And he said, I want to talk to you about something more sustainable. And so what's happening in the fossil fuel industry is that they know that within the next, by 2035, that they're going to be changing their operations, but they want to get as much out of the ground and as much production going until then. And it's not about modernization. The project that they had proposed in the EIR was supposed to be a modernization project. I am not from California, but I had moved here, and I was within a mile of the explosion on the day of the explosion. And I was experiencing some things. I thought I was going to get over it, and then I had to go to the hospital 2 days later. And my hospital visit was taken, the response was taken aspirin. And so the excuse was, is, you know, being a new, you know, newly moving here to California, I was told, well, you know, the reason why the explosion happened was because Richmond refused to approve a modernization project that would have totally restored the plant, and the explosion might not have happened. And so I said, okay. And now that we look at the EIR, which is 10,000 pages, it increases greenhouse gases, and 61 more pollutants will be emitted from this project. And so it wasn't about modernization. It was about whatever it takes for them to continue to do this. So as a person that has lived in a fence line community, I wake up day to day and I see them polluting from day to day, regardless of whether it's legal or not. They do a lot of illegal activities, and they know that they're not going to be fined. The consequences are not great enough. Mm-hmm. So I've decided that it's time for us to build something totally outside of what's going on. And I know that they're looking 40 years ahead, because since they're deciding that 2035 they're not going to produce any more oil, then we're going to decide, well, we're going to create a 40-year plan, and we need to start working with the youth and these young adults who are in these maker and hacker spaces, who are building these things. There's people that are saying, hey, you know, I talked about an incubator, and somebody responded to me, it's going to cost too much money, it's going to be this. I said, well, guess what? These young people are working on it right now as we speak. They're working on a new economy as we speak, including environmental justice, ecological renewal. We have the Greenway in Richmond, California, and that was an old railroad track that has been converted to a community garden. There is a better way. And one, a couple of things that came out yesterday was that, okay, we have this modernization project that's going to to hire 1,000 union labor workers. But if we had a full modernization project, modernization project, we could hire 3,000 workers possibly. And so that's what we're looking at. We're holding them accountable, and as well as forging a new path, hopefully.
Yeah. So sadly, we're running short of time, but Elliot and Burke, you have time to sort of put those images out there, those visions that you have for that new economy that's coming up.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that is most hopeful to me right now is the fight that Stephanie is talking about. And I just really want to thank her for her leadership and the leadership of folks in Richmond who are fighting back against the Chevron refinery. And part of that leadership includes rank-and-file union workers. And one of the things that I thought was most beautiful up in Richmond that union workers did that was on a smaller-scale action that folks usually think about direct actions as picket signs and civil disobedience. But workers up in Richmond and North Richmond in particular that has been devastated by the foreclosure crisis, which we need to keep in mind is directly related to the kind of economy that we have, the same economy that's creating a climate crisis. Those union workers reclaimed land next to abandoned lots in their community, and together with an organization called Planting Justice up in Richmond, cleared the land in one day with 30 union workers and other volunteers, and planted fruit trees, planted a vegetable garden, planted herb gardens for workers who are fighting on the job for justice. They were in the middle of a contract fight at the Casino San Pablo, but who are oftentimes having to work second and third jobs just to make ends meet, decided, you know, the land belongs to those who work it, and we're going to grow food to support ourselves, our community, and our coworkers as we stand in this fight. And I think that is a beautiful example, and we need to do more of that, creating climate resilience. It also gives us the inspiration and the moral authority to demand that that happen at a larger scale. Why isn't all unused land in Richmond used to grow food? And if folks want to check out some resources about what that can look like, there's a great letter from 60 different organizations that are part of the Climate Justice Alliance, which is a national organization of environmental justice and climate justice organizations fighting to remake economy for people and planet. They wrote a letter last year to the AFL-CIO, the largest labor federation in the country, calling on us to create a shared struggle for that new economy. There's also a great video that was produced out of Richmond with a lot of those organizations, from AT-192, the transit workers, the California Nurses Association, to folks doing solar stuff and gardening up in Richmond. You can search for it on YouTube. It's called Keystone XL Has a Job for You, and it's sort of the Daily Show, Colbert Report-style satire about what are the kinds of jobs that we're getting out of this extreme energy economy, because as Stephanie mentioned, there's a carbon bubble, right? There are five times as much carbon buried underground that these extreme energy corporations have already put on the market, that have already speculated against and are counting on their books, than we could possibly burn and still be alive on this planet. And so what is that about, that we're counting on jobs and we're counting on investment on assets that they can't even use? It's like the tech bubble or the housing bubble, and it's going to burst.
All right, so we have a minute left. Elliot, where should people get together? Where are some of the next steps?
Well, we actually have three protests coming up on Monday, April 28th. As part of the Earth Day to May Day actions. And there's that full calendar, like I said, Earth Day to May Day assembly.noblogs.org. There's a protest against the Koch brothers, pet Koch facility. The Koch brothers, have been a major influence in dismantling workers' rights, militarizing our borders, corrupting the media, the destruction of the environment. And, so they have a bunch of issues. We're going to be having a protest against Chevron.
We're going to have Earth Day march with the children tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow's Earth Day in San Francisco. Go check it out. This was Terra Verde, your weekly environmental talk show, KPFA, 94.1 FM. Check out the archives. Thanks to Apollo for the beats and to Erica on the controls.
You are invited to a crab feed or tri-tip dinner. It's your choice. Saturday, April 26th, to benefit the Antioch Rivertown Jamboree. This event is being held at St. George's Social Hall, East 13th Anne-Marie Street in Antioch. Enjoy music, raffles, an auction, and more, including no-host drinks at 6 o'clock
and dinner at 7 p.m. This is Community Family Fun Time at the Hall. Once again, that's Saturday, April 26th, St. George's Social Hall, East 13th Anne Marie Street in Antioch, for your choice of a crab feed or tri-tip dinner.